DW Africa Link. Thousands of people have been killed and millions have been forced to flee their homes due to extremist violence in the Sahel. Junta-led countries like Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have been severely affected. So what impact has the introduction of Russian forces had on the fight against terror? And what more needs to be done to tackle the crisis? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter.
Africa Link, every weekday, here on DW.
The Sahel region has been battling extremist groups for almost a decade. But so far, not much has been achieved in terms of stopping the insurgents. The junta leaders of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger justified their takeovers by citing the inability of civilian governments to address the rising threats from extremist groups in the region. They have now sought alternative security arrangements with Russian forces while distancing themselves from former colonial powers like France. For more on this, let's bring in my colleague Bram Postumus, DW correspondent in the Sahel region. Also joining us is Ryan Cummins, a security analyst from Signal Risk in South Africa, specializing in sub-Saharan Africa. So we are talking about extremism in the Sahel region and the fight against it. And, you know, it's been a bit of a back and forth regarding who is helping who fight against this extremism. But before we delve into, you know, all that back and forth, Bram, when we talk about extremism in the Sahel region, what is the situation on the ground and how is it affecting lives?
Well, let's skirt the issue of what we actually mean when we talk about extremism, because that's obviously a whole different debate, which is to be had as well. But the situation on the ground when it comes to the actual battle situation on the ground is very bad at this particular point. We've just had a absolutely horrific massacre in Barcelona, which is in the northeastern corner of Burkina Faso, where perhaps even hundreds of people were killed. The exact circumstances are not entirely clear, but that is something that has shocked the nation and very, very profoundly, because this is the worst that's happened ever since this problem came onto Burkinabe territory about 10 years ago. And the same is happening in Mali and in Niger. After the coups happened, there was a security vacuum, which is entirely predictable, because when the military start playing politics, they lose they get their eye off the ball, if you like, and that's to defend your national territory. So that vacuum has been filled up by these armed non-state groups who obviously have no business being where they are, but have taken the opportunity to grab positions, influence, even policy making beyond the country's borders, and are a very fixed presence that's going to be extremely difficult to get rid of.
Right. Right. We're going to be digging more and more into that. But Ryan, from what I'm understanding from Bram, I mean, especially looking at the recent attack where hundreds of people are reported to have been killed, what are we saying then? Is extremism on the ground even getting worse? I'm asking this because, I mean, again, with the back and forth, there were Western forces helping to fight against extremism. Many of the locals thought that they were not doing their job and the situation was still dire. Then we're talking about introducing Russian forces, especially looking at countries like Mali and Burkina Faso, and it seems it's still not stopping. What's going on?
Yeah, certainly. I think when we just look at the numbers, casualty figures specifically, one would be hard pressed to suggest that the situation is not getting worse in the Sahel. As Bram mentioned, the political instability that has been induced by these coup d'etats, which have obviously overthrown democratically elected governments, and which has seen the rise of juntas who have essentially cut or severed You know, a lot of military agreements that they had with Western partners that was providing them not always necessarily operational support on the ground, but also kind of logistical and financial support in, you know, augmenting the counterterrorism capacities of the states. And, you know, since these coups happened, a lot of those agreements have fallen by the wayside. In fact, they've actually just been severed in their entirety by these juntas, who are obviously looking for security partnerships now outside of the Western geopolitical bloc. This has come at the direct expense of the security dynamics, you know, within their countries. Obviously, less resources, less financial resources, less logistical support, less operational support means that the counterterrorism capacity of these states have been weakened. And these security vacuums, which have been are readily being filled, I should say, by these extremist movements who now, you know, no longer, for example, have the prevailing operations of French, you know, air force, you know, targeting their positions from the air, or even, you know, special forces of the United States training some of the Nigerian counterparts in the Diffa region. All of this has fallen by the wayside. You know, this is readily enhanced the operations of these extremist groups and allowed them to not only increase the intensity of their violence, but also expand the geographical scope of their operations.
Right. It seems to me then that both you, Bram, and Ryan are suggesting that the situation on the ground has even gotten worse with the introduction of the Russian forces. I'm assuming that's what we're gathering from this. But so then, for many thinking, what has been achieved so far with the introduction of Russian forces on the ground?
Well, if I can answer that one, Eddie, from our perspective, they've really worsened the situation that they've been, you know, kind of contracted to resolve. I think when we specifically look at Mali, which is the country where, you know, Russian forces and paramilitary forces in the guise of Wagner Group or Africa Corps, whatever they call themselves these days, you know, their operations were supposed to, you know, resolve, you know, the terrorism dynamics. It was supposed to stem the frequency of attacks. It was supposed to undermine the operational capabilities of these extremist groups. But the exact opposite has happened. And one of the key reasons for this is that these forces, alongside their Malian counterparts, have been accused of gross human rights abuses. They've gone into communities which are deemed to be sympathetic or ethnically aligned to some of these extremist groups, who we know have ties to transnationalist extremist organizations such as Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And they've gone on and essentially decimated certain communities. You know, no investigative process, no form of judicial intervention. You know, these militaries, these Russian forces, alongside their local counterparts, have essentially been, you know, judge, jury, and executor in these instances. And the dynamic that this has created, you know, has been that communities who are now no longer perceived as being secured by the state, they see the state as being a potential enemy, are looking for protection, you know, from these extremist groups who are exceptionally, you know, taking advantage of prevailing, you know, political conditions in these countries. They are able to radicalize and recruit amongst these communities and thereby bolster their ranks. And this has obviously allowed them to, as I mentioned, you know, increase the intensity of their violence, but also increase the, you know, geographical scope of their operations as they tend to kind of infiltrate using various communities. Right. So the operations by Russian forces have certainly done far more harm than they've done good.
Maybe just one more element to add into this. You may recall that in November last year, the rebel stronghold of Kidal was taken by the Malian army and the mercenaries from Russia, which had to do with getting rid of a rebel Tuareg movement that had its headquarters there. And what has happened since in that region has been exactly the kind of terrible human rights abuses that Ryan mentioned in that particular zone, targeting, you know, people, presumed to be sympathetic to the Tuareg rebel movement. And what this has done, it has created a refugee problem, which the neighboring country Algeria is very upset about. It has also made sure that the rebels are regrouping. And about 2 weeks ago, they have presented what you could even term a bill when they went to Tinzawaten in the north on the border with Algeria and killed quite a large number of Wagner mercenaries and Malian army personnel. That was revenge for what happened in that region after Kidal was taken.
Right. So, Bram, especially when coup hits countries of Mali and Burkina Faso, we saw a lot of people out on the streets, you know, showing the flags of Russia. Clearly, there was some sort of affinity towards Russia because they felt Russia could help them fight against extremists. You, as our correspondent on the ground, has been in touch with many on the ground. What are they saying now about Russia?
Well, in many cases, the opinion on the streets and on the ground hasn't changed. And one of the most important reasons for that is quite simply that people have no access to information that suggests otherwise. One of the things that the juntas in Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger have been very, very conscious in and very strict in is the restricting of the gathering of free information. So where previously you had a wide array of media in various languages available to you, what you are subjected to these days, if you live in Bamako or in Niamey or in Ouagadougou, is pure propaganda. And that means that people are a lot less informed than they were. But just to make a quick note about what people were thinking when there was this groundswell movement against the government of the late President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, who was overthrown by this junta. I asked people, okay, what do you expect? You know, what if Ibrahim Boubacar Keita goes or is overthrown and the Russians come in? What's going to happen? And people were having a very unrealistic image of what Russia could do for them. Because they are really not aware of what war is like, for instance, in a place like Ukraine, or they're not aware of what happened in a region like Chechnya, which, as we all know, was destroyed at the start of this century. And they were really incredulous when you would share with them the actual activities of Russian forces, be they mercenary, be they regular, on the ground. And I think because of the deprivation of reliable information right now in these three countries, it is difficult to see a change of perspective. And of course, you also have the true believers who are diehard, you know, in the support for the juntas and will say no other alternative will be palatable.
Right, right. At some point, I guess, when they actually look at the situation on the ground, it will be clear if it's working out or it's not working out. But Ryan, let me come to you on this, because for me, this begs the question, you know, of trying to understand Russia's strategy in the Sahel. What is it? What they came mainly to help fight against extremism, with what strategy?
Well, I think it's twofold, to be honest. There's obviously the idea of undermining, you know, the geopolitical West in the region. We know that France, specifically in the Sahel, has always been quite, I wouldn't say strong, but has been the dominant, if I can call it, foreign power in the region. Russia has obviously, you know, attempted to undermine that. And this is, you know, kind of widely speaking, ties into the geopolitical competition that takes place and which has obviously been intensified, you know, due to Russia's conflict with Ukraine and, you know, the fact that a lot of the Western geopolitical bloc, specifically the European Union, has obviously aligned itself more with Ukraine than it has with Russia in terms of this conflict. But there's also the other issue, you know, which Bram as well is very well aware of and probably can expand on, is the issue of financial concessions and access to strategic minerals, which Russia is able to achieve in these conflict-ridden zones. So when the country, or when the Russian forces first came to the African continent, you know, I would say within the past decade or so, you know, the operations were squarely focused on places such as the Central African Republic, Sudan and Libya, you know, countries that were also facing some form of or degree of destabilization, but where, you know, there were certain resources, specifically gold, that was, you know, readily being able to kind of smuggle out of the country, and where they could essentially exploit these resources, you know, for their own gain. Interestingly enough, with Mali and Burkina Faso in particular, we've seen some not only the Russian engagement from a national security perspective, but also Russian companies, you know, starting to now enter the so-called, you know, if I can call it, extractive sector of these countries, or specifically, you know, some of the Wagner operatives themselves, you know, trying to establish a territorial control in areas that are rich with resources. So there's a multitudinous factors, you know, some political, some economic, and some financial, right, you know, that is informing Russia's strategy on the continent.
Right. Bram, one would argue that based on what Ryan is saying, Russia is just continuing the strategy that the West was in the region anyways. I mean, who doesn't like African minerals? Who doesn't want to somehow have some political influence? You know, who doesn't want to, you know, make sure they are benefiting as much from helping any country fight insurgents? Is there any difference, Bram?
Well, the only differences really are, you know, gradual, in the sense that the methodology that Russia uses to ostensibly be engaged in this whole fight against terrorism are a lot more violent and a lot more destructive, because that's the way they tend to operate. But when it comes to why they are there, there is no substantial difference between, you know, any Western power or indeed Russia when it comes to getting your hands on minerals and selling them on the market, or indeed having your companies protected against any insurrectionist group or whatever, to make sure that the operations are safe. The juntas are not able to guarantee those things any more than the previous governments were, and that was the promise on which they were engaged in their power grab. So in that sense, again, we come back to the situation on the ground. There hasn't been any substantial improvement, not from the point of view of, you know, any partner that happens to be there and is honest about this, and certainly not from the point of view of the people living in those areas.
So here's what I'm getting now. The Western forces were being accused of not doing enough to fight against extremism. Russian forces, as I'm understanding, are not doing enough. It seems the situation may even be getting worse. Is there a scenario where, if the aim is actually to fight extremism, that both strategies were just not working? Is it the strategy that is just not working? What needs to be done to make it work? I'm going to start with you, Ryan, on this.
So that is certainly the million-dollar question. I think that when we look at conflict within any specific context, but specifically one where you have a non-state armed actor that's essentially engaging in conflict against a state, one realizes that the measures or strategy employed by the state to counter the non-state actor usually, from a military perspective, only addresses the symptoms and not necessarily the causes of the conflict. Up until now, the strategy by, you know, states in the Sahel, whether they've leveraged off, you know, European or Western forces, or whether they've leveraged off Russian forces, they focus on addressing the symptoms and not the causes of these insurgencies, or why these terrorism groups are receiving the support that they're receiving. And I know it seems like it's an issue which we speak about on a regular basis, but the only way to provide a long-standing and binding solution, you know, to this issue is through good governance. It's essentially providing local populations a better contract, a better social contract than these extremist groups are able to do. So that means being able to provide them with a stable political environment, being able to ensure that they've got democratic rights and access to their civil liberties, providing them an economic environment in which they are able to build businesses and feed themselves and have adequate shelter. I mean, these factors are not difficult to kind of contemplate as a solution, but they seem to be exceptionally difficult to implement from a state-centric perspective. But I think that, you know, when you listen to the rhetoric of these juntas and you know, the messaging they're putting out there, it seems that focusing on actually improving the lives of communities impacted by this violence is certainly secondary, you know, to continuously focus on a military-centric solution, which is significantly costly, which has obviously a high cost when it comes to, you know, human resources and also human life at the end of the day, that, right, you know, one just does not see the situation changing or improving anytime soon.
Right, because it hasn't. It's been going on for decades. We've constantly been talking about it, and it's the same thing over and over again, and it's innocent lives that are lost. But Bram, based on what Ryan was saying, quite interesting, because then it really leads to trying to find out what is causing increasing extremism in the Sahel. Is it really just as Ryan is saying, because the extremists can somehow make conditions of people's lives better because the government itself is not doing it? Or is there something more to it? What's causing the rise?
Well, as Ryan was saying, it's very much a question of governance, and that is part of the entire equation. Especially in the case of the Al-Qaeda affiliated groups, what you have seen in the areas that they have under their control up to a certain extent is that they have set up parallel structures that answer to what people are looking for, and people are looking for security. Even if that security takes the form of a protection racket, which these groups are essentially engaged in, they will accept it because it's better than nothing. It's the same with rudimentary education, rudimentary other services. You know, that is the kind of thing that people have been deprived of because they tend to see the state and its representatives, especially in uniform, as predators. But if you, as Ryan already suggests, and I totally agree with him there, this military-centric solution that has been at the heart of all these supposed solutions that have been brought into the Sahel region, be they French, American, or now Russian, don't work because they don't address the root causes. Right. And one of the main areas there, one of the main things, the main key terminology that I always have been using is marginalization. Where the violence is in areas that have been totally marginalized, are being regarded as almost irrelevant from the perspective of the capital cities of these countries. It's far away, it's up in the desert or in the desertifying savanna region. It's like the people who live there, who have very little in the way of economic perspectives and trying to get by and survive as best they can, don't have the kind of political clout they need to make themselves heard. And the only way this happens is when violence occurs. And then suddenly people sit up and start taking notice. And this is a perspective that hasn't changed with the juntas in power, because they are centered on the capital cities as well. That's where they play politics. That's where they engage those partners that they have chosen to be their allies. And the root causes, what you're looking at is a holistic approach, if you like. It's a bit of a fat term, but what it essentially means is that you, first of all, go there and ask people what they need, what they're looking for. Sounds like a revolutionary concept, but it's not happening. We're always talking over people's heads. We're not talking with them. And ask them, okay, what are you looking for? And the answers will be very simple. We want decent hospitals or at least health facilities. We want security. We want decent roads and bridges. And we want our kids to go to school in safety. That is not terribly complicated, but it's extremely complicated to realize if these marginalized zones do not have the political clout in the capital cities to make this happen. This dynamic is at the heart of the problem and hasn't been changed.
Definitely seems to be the situation we're looking at now. let's wrap this up. I'm going to give you, Ryan, the final words here. I have a dream. I have this scenario that I want to put across to get your thoughts on. Is there a scenario where Russian forces or Russian strategy together with Western forces or Western strategy, and who knows, maybe even the Chinese will get roped in all of this, that together there's a scenario where they can help tackle the situation on the ground in the Sahel?
I think that will remain a dream, if I must be honest, Eddie. The core issue is that, again, there are competing ideologies, there are competing interests, which, unfortunately, when we see a world that is, being increasingly divided, along geopolitical lines, that countries specifically in Africa and in the rest of the developing world where there is this geopolitical competition essentially become proxies for these countries. And that, there is a strong hesitancy amongst the world's superpowers to collaborate, in situations where they can rather compete. They're always going to choose the latter. If I can, I know that I've been focusing a lot on the bad and what's going wrong. If I can focus maybe a little bit on what could be done differently, is perhaps that African states should stop looking outside of the continent for its solutions. If we can leverage more on the resources, the human capital that we have on this continent or even within sub-regions of this continent, perhaps that is where our solution lies. And I guess that is the best way that I can end off this discussion.
That's it from this edition of Africa Link. Join the conversation on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. Click follow so you don't miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. And I am Eddie Micah Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW. Made for Minds.